convene the Senate Revenue Committee. On our agenda today is a work session on Senate Bill 464 and a public hearing possible work session, House Bill 2129. And I just want to advise Senator Hartung that we do have an evening session tonight that starts at 6 o'clock, so if you can hold your comments down on these two bills, we'll be able to get out in time for that session. Thank you, Senator, for your
Thank you very much.
Senate Bill 4, I'll open a work session, Senate Bill 464. Senate Bill 464, as you know, is a bill that I've had introduced that would create, began with a corporate and personal income tax credit for schools, essentially, and charitable organizations, foundations, and so forth, to be of additional assistance to education. That idea is apparently widely popular, very popular. So popular, in fact, that others want to take advantage of this charitable giving opportunity and have sought to attach themselves to this idea, and that is just fine with the chair. I noted with some interest, even in today's news, I think it was today's news, about how the revenue committees of the House and Senate are U.S., I don't know, a lot, no,
no, no,
Oregon,
here.
Oh, yeah, right
here,
in River City, yeah, are actually allowing taxpayers to keep some of their own money to use it for purposes they believe are beneficial. And it's shocking. But if we pass this bill, that trend would continue, and in my view, that'd be good. However, one of the ideas that Senator Starr has brought to my attention is contained in Senate Bill 126. Now, Senator Starr, would you like to comment about the aims of Senate Bill 126?
The aims there would be similar to what we're proposing in looking here, that contributions made to a foundation that provides funding for education in private schools might also receive a tax credit benefit for those contributions. Now, already we allow deductibility for contributions to religious institutions, and I believe this small tax credit that we propose would be a further incentive for those people who would be encouraged, might be encouraged to give small amounts in support of these types of foundations. And so I would like to see us, instead of using the Senate Bill 464, which has a relating to public-only type of education, that we would use a bill that's related to taxation, and we might, in fact, do some good for other institutions of education that already save the state millions of dollars per year through the education of these children. So that's where I would like to see us go.
All right. We had at an earlier meeting Mr. Johnson from Legislative Council, who had suggested that a Supreme Court opinion of ours had a rather narrow view, I think, of that kind of giving. But Mr. Johnson is here, and if you would come up and refresh my recollection about the Supreme Court of Oregon's view on these kinds of contributions, that would be helpful to the chair and hopefully to the other members.
Mr. Chair, members, good afternoon. Dr. Johnson, Legislative Council Office. Yes, basically, I guess what I'd like to do is start with a bit of a historical background and say that there are two relevant constitutional provisions for tax benefits flowing to religious schools, one of which is the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, and the other one of which is Section 5, Article 1 of the Oregon Constitution. Under the United States Constitution, over the past 15 or 20 years or so, the federal courts have basically decided that tax credits that benefit religious schools are permitted under the First Amendment if there's a secular purpose to the tax credit legislation, if the credit does not advance or inhibit religion, and if the credit does not ultimately foster an excessive entanglement between government and religion. And generally, if there is someone, say a parent or a contributor, who actually makes the decision that I would like to benefit this religious school and thereby make the contribution, or decides I'm going to send my child to this school and therefore pay tuition, and a tax credit flows directly to that individual, even though the ultimate beneficiary may be the school, that sort of thing is permitted at the federal level. In order for legislation to be valid, it would have to also comply, of course, with the Oregon Constitution. And in Oregon, there is this Section 5, Article 1, which prohibits any money from being drawn for the state treasury for the benefit of religious institutions. This provision has been interpreted very broadly by the Oregon Supreme Court, most notably in the case Dickman versus Clackamas School District number 64, which admittedly is at this point a rather old case, decided in the early 60s. In that case, the court said that Section 5, Article 1 prohibited the state from, actually this was the school district, but indirectly the state from furnishing textbooks to parochial schools in Clackamas County, despite the fact that those textbooks were non-religious in nature. Essentially, the court said that any benefit that a parochial school derived was a benefit that assisted the religious function of the school, therefore was prohibited under Section 5, Article 1. Now, you may note that what we're contemplating here, what you are contemplating here, is that it's not a direct benefit either of property or money to a religious school, but rather a tax credit. And it is arguable that a tax credit is not does not result in money being drawn from the state treasury for the benefit of the religious school. Nevertheless, economically, that's not the result of the tax credit. The tax credit, in fact, directly lowers the amount of money otherwise available in the state treasury. And in fact, that relationship, that economic relationship, has been officially recognized by the legislature in the legislative findings in the Budget Accountability Act, which is the procedure that must be followed when the state adopts its budget. It expressly provides that tax credits and tax expenditures of other kinds are the same thing as direct expenditures by the state, because they result in a lowering of tax revenues and thereby a greater tax rate. So while it is perhaps arguable that a tax credit would be viewed as something that does not directly result in money being transferred from the state treasury to the benefit of religious institutions, I think there's certainly a strong argument going the other way as well.
The last couple of paragraphs you just uttered, are you suggesting that's the court's view, or are you saying that's someone's
legal opinion. In terms of this, the credit being viewed as an expenditure, that has actually been determined by the court?
That, Mr. Chair, that has actually been determined by the Legislative Assembly. It correctly provides in the Budget Accountability Act that tax credits and other tax expenditures are the equivalent of direct expenditures by the state.
If we followed that, I mean, well, one thing about 126, and we won't hold you personally responsible for all these answers, but on 126, if you created a credit that allowed a citizen a variety of options, among which would be a contribution to a private entity, perhaps affiliated with some religious activity, you haven't necessarily directed, in my view, any of the state's resources toward a religious activity. Simply allowed that decision to be made by the taxpayer, by the person who's directing their own money.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is the argument that you would make, and I'm just alerting you to the fact that it may be, if you were to proceed down this course, you may be at risk of the court concluding otherwise.
I mean, couldn't you also then suggest that if we return the kicker, that citizens would have more of their own money returned to them, and therefore they would be freely able to spend it on whatever they so chose, including sending their children to a private school that might have some religious affiliation, and therefore we have helped them out. And some would argue that that was unconstitutional. I know that I'm pushing here, but I'm just saying I think it's also then it's rather bizarre that we treat credits as expenditures, even in the first instance.
Mr. Chair, that you could make that argument, but there is no, you would not be stating anywhere in the legislation anything. Legislation, for example, the particular legislation is already in the book. There's no provision at all concerning.
It's a reasonably foreseeable outcome. But not directed, not referenced specifically by legislation.
That's correct.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Dexter, forgive me if I missed a piece of something that you've already covered when I asked the question, but from a legal context, what's the difference between allowing a deduction to a religious organization and offering a credit?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, there's no difference at all, and that brings up another point I would like to highlight. Under Oregon's existing income tax system, of course, the state piggybacks off of the federal Internal Revenue Code, and under the Internal Revenue Code, charitable contributions made to charitable entities, including typically religious schools, are deductible under Section 170 of the Code for both federal and state tax purposes. However, in that situation, you have a case where religious schools are one among a large class of entities for which charitable contributions can be made in a deduction claim.
So if we mirrored that kind of a language and said you can take a tax credit for a contribution made to a public or charitable organization, including a public or charitable organization organized under, I can't remember the 101.
Yeah, allowable,
organized for educational, cultural, or arts activities, for example, would
not a problem.
That's not a problem.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that it is clear cut that there's a problem here with the amendment that's proposed. However, at some point there is a line between a direct payment of money from the state to a religious school, and this other point where you have religious schools being among a very large class of entities for which a deduction is allowable upon contribution. And where that line is not entirely clear.
So I would assume then your advice would be, if we intend to go down that route, the closer we get to some language that's parallel to the existing deduction language, the safer the ground would be under our feet?
Mr. Chair, Senator Barr, yes, that's right. The broader you can make this class of contributors, of organizations that can receive a contribution and get a credit as a result thereof, the better off will be in terms of risk of litigation.
Mr. Johnson, my understanding that we give church property a preference in the tax code, land. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. That also, virtually every, I think every state that has property tax taxes does that, and that is a...
How can we defend that if this other potential credit mechanism is viewed with such suspicion?
Mr. Chair, the courts have always viewed that property tax exemption as something that is, in essence, predates the Constitution, which is true. The property tax exemption for religious or churches and other religious institutions was in existence before the Oregon Constitution, and they, for that reason, they have always created this historical exception.
Appreciate
you.
Or just inconsistent, I guess.
Inconsistent, or certainly inconsistent with the Dickman ruling, which is a very broad interpretation. The other thing I'd like to note is that there are a number of other states that have language identical, very similar to Section 5, Article 1, and some of those states have recently allowed tax credits of this kind. Others have not gone that route yet.
All right. Yes, sure. I think you understand that this state went along that road. And again, to make a record.
I mean, some citizen challenged the wisdom of this assembly.
That's right.
In a legal way. All right. Well, thank you very much, Dexter. Appreciate your being here. I'm not assuming that I gave Dexter a copy of a letter that was addressed to Mr. Lamb, written by Mr. Bullock and Mr. Berry. I don't know if Mr. Lamb or Mr. Bullock or Barry or Sangna, if you care to comment briefly on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bob Castagna representing the Oregon Catholic Conference. We would urge the committee to favorably look upon Senate Bill 126 with an amendment to include private as well as public elementary or secondary school districts. Our point, consistent with the opinion submitted to you by the Institute for Justice through Senator Starr, is that a tax credit is a relationship between the taxpayer and the state of Oregon. This is not a direct appropriation of funds from the legislature to private schools. This is an election of a choice by a taxpayer as to whether or not the taxpayer chooses to make a contribution and how the state will treat that relationship to that particular taxpayer's contribution. So we would urge, consistent with the opinion of the Arizona Supreme Court, Arizona having a constitutional provision similar to Oregon's constitution, the Arizona Supreme Court finding the Arizona tax credit constitutional under the Arizona Constitution, and that the potential is there for the Oregon Supreme Court to find similarly if such a tax credit proposal were enacted and or challenged and brought before the Oregon Supreme Court.
Senator Wilde.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think if we go the 126 route, we probably should include in the amendments making it an exception to previous legislation that's taking place in the state, so we aren't in violation of what has previously been passed, stating that a credit is an expenditure of funds, and simply make this an exception to that. That would be my opinion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, committee, I also want to advise you, Mr. Harvey, do you want to come forward? You may recall that Mr. Harvey was here on Senate Bill 680, and it had to do with a tax credit for contributions to a cultural institution or other institution of informal learning. That out
right, Mr. Chair.
And you are proposing that we blend that language into whether it's 464 or 126, but you'd like that concept considered?
Yes, Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Larry Harvey. I'm here on behalf of the Cultural Advocacy Coalition. Initially, we had amendments drafted to be moved into Senate Bill 464. I do not believe that they would be in conflict with anything that might be in Senate Bill 126 either, but you do have a copy or should have a copy of Dash 4 amendments there that just came up within the last hour from the Legislative Council, also drafted by Mr. Johnson. And it simply outlines, as the concept in 680, when we did have to conduct a public hearing on that, there was a strong suggestion, an interest on behalf of the committee, and a suggestion that perhaps all these ideas should be developed into one piece of legislation. We're very happy with that. We wouldn't mind at all. The Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 464 simply outline the criteria for what would be the qualifications for an institution of informal learning. Obviously, it would need to be a nonprofit. It would need to be, as one described in Section 501C of the Internal Revenue Code, and its primary purposes are outlined here with having to do with cultural, heritage, humanities programs, or visual or performing arts. And the most important is that it has a signed working agreement with one or more public or elementary schools in the state of Oregon, schools or school districts. So the purpose then being that these institutions would be working in conjunction with institutions of learning to develop curriculum, provide for residencies for a variety of different people. It would not be in place of, as we had stipulated in another committee, it would not be in place of licensed teachers. They would be in addition to, so they would still be under the supervision of the licensed teachers in the classroom.
Question. However, the amendment here has signed an agreement of partnership with one or more public elementary or secondary schools or school districts in this state. In light of our discussion about broadening the scope of this bill, would it be agreeable if you just what has signed agreement with a partnership with one or more elementary or secondary schools or school districts in this state without necessarily limiting the activity to public schools?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm sure that wouldn't offend any of the members of the board of directors for the Cultural Advocacy Coalition.
Does that happen now?
Does that
happen?
Do you offend them?
Huh?
Does they offend them?
No, I was wondering if you have some such signed agreements right now with other than public schools or...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't know of any circumstance where it is happening now. I don't know that it would be precluded. I know of examples where there are nonprofit organizations that are providing these links as a result of grants from charitable organizations, and so there doesn't seem to be any conflict from within the context of the purpose. And we have something in
going on in the state of Oregon right now. There's actually a coalition between, at this point, only public schools, middle schools, supported by the American Cancer Society, and a group of givers to that organization, and is being developed by the Portland Opera. So it has to do with smoking cessation. So it's a great way to leverage money for a number of organizations.
All right. Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Waters?
Yes.
Well, now, Senator Beyer has come up with some language that might be blended into 126. And Mr. Johnson has it. And if you'd come up and read that into the record and then give us your comment, you think it would be a nice way to word everything.
Mr. Chair, members again, Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council Office. The language here is taxpayers may take a 50% tax credit up to a maximum of $50 per tax year for contributions made to public or nonprofit organizations organized under Section 501 of the Internal Revenue Code. And then I think we may need some research to determine that's a large section and covers a lot of organizations. There's a specific provision in there for the NFL, actually, among other things.
We just give the sports action that
yeah, but how about professional wrestling?
That's coming.
That's coming.
That
wasn't there. But it's
really
limited.
So, anyways, I need to do a little research to see what subjects that are should be there. And then it goes on to say, in support of educational, sports, cultural, and arts activity.
Are there comments from the members about pursuing an amendment of that type? All right. Well, I think that's what we'll do, and we won't come to a conclusion on this bill today, but it would be, yes, Senator Barr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think if we're going to go down this route, we're talking about very small givers. I've got to say that a different way. Small givers. I don't think this has any effect at all, nor is it intended to have any effect on people who are traditionally large contributors at all. And trying to get people there and the things that they would be interested in, and my guess is that we're probably safer if we make it broader, less specific, and rather than trying to narrow it down and trying to get into that whole definition of schools and stuff. We better all stand away from it and trying to get as close to the IRS code as we could.
I appreciate that suggestion, and we will have those amendments drafted, and we'll then reschedule whatever the appropriate bill with the right relating clause would be.
Mr. Chair, this is going to go on.
I believe that's the best vehicle. It's relating to taxation, so that's fairly broad.
That's really broad.
Yeah, I've got some ideas.
All right, thank you very much. If there's nothing further to come before the committee on this bill, 464, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 464. We'll now open up a public hearing on House Bill 2129. And Mr. Waters, are you?
I'm getting ready.
You're leaving?
She's here.
Oh, Elizabeth is here.
That's what it says.
We haven't seen her for ages.
Right,
no. Oops, to whom were you referring?
Oh,
there. Please,
all right.
Give us some background on 2129.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin Mahar, and House Bill 2129 deals with a variety of different topics, and I'll just try to go through some of them briefly, but I know Jim and Ari will go through it section by section for you. But it's dealing with late filing fees for exempt organizations, the appeals board requirements, and clarifications of exempt claims. And then we also just have, I'll just point out the amendments that we have. We have a dash A-12, and the A-12 is dealing with changing when the clerk of the Board of Property Tax Appeals has to give public notice, and currently in law they have to give notice the first Monday in February, but this is going to change it so that they can just have that public notice up before the date that the Board of Property Tax Appeals actually convenes their meeting. And then you have a -A13, and what this amendment is doing is it's just clarifying in existing law how urban renewal agencies, and they each of them have, you know, an option that they had to choose in 1997. So the urban renewal agencies that are under option 3, how exactly they're going to have this calculation of the amount of the division of tax. And it's just trying to stipulate that the amount collected by that division of tax cannot exceed the amount that is stated in the ordinance to be that particular amount of the collection of the division of tax. And then finally, the A15, what this is doing is there was a couple sections that didn't get deleted in the A and Gross, and so sections 8 and 9 are deleted because this is already something that we've taken care of in House Bill 2044. And then section 30 is just adding a new section, and this is allowing owners of industrial plants to elect to not provide an itemization of their operating expenses or their income to the Department of Revenue for appraisal purposes of their real market value.
All right. Thank you.
And basically, just make it clear, there's a lot of changes in the bill. You'll see it, you know, it's over 10 pages long, but none of these are having a substantial change that is going to have a revenue impact. So that's why I gave you just a staff measure summary. It's not a revenue loss or gain from this particular measure.
We'll see what we can do about that.
Okay.
All right, Mr. Maneri, you want to come and give us a run through?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Maneri with the Department of Revenue. I do have a summary of a different element, so I'll give you a quick run through. This bill is mainly a product of after the implementation of Measure 50 last session, which is about a 250-page bill. Some issues came up in the meantime, and actually, for what's really a cleanup measure, there wasn't too much we had to do, but there are some issues that we caught. One of them is, some of them are related to the fact that prior to Measure 50, the assessed value on property was usually the market value. Now with Measure 50 and the limit on assessment, it can be either the market value or the limit value is lower. So, for instance, in sections 1 through 3, what we have is the it deals with late filing penalties for exemptions. So this is your exemption. You have to file for it by April 1st, but the legislature has provided, especially for a lot of charitable voluntary organizations, sometimes they miss it. So you have a late filing penalty based on what was assessed value, and that was market before. But now assessed value on exemptions is zero. So that doesn't make any sense. So we're just changing it back to say market of what, how you calculate the penalty. Otherwise, there'd be no penalty in any instance. That's sections 1 and 2 does that, and 3 and 3 is the implementation of them. Section 4 has to do with the calculation of the Measure 50 limit, and in the law. What you've done is said that you're going to calculate a limit on the total value of the total value of the property. It was paralleling Measure 47, which was the total tax on the property, and then you want to say, okay, we'll change it to the value. And so, but what was put in is language that was put in a number of places. There on page 3, line 28. This is for the assessment rule. What goes on the assessment rule, you included again assessed value, maximum assessed value, and the real market value on land, and then in line 30 for buildings, so they'd be separate, when in fact there's only one limit calculation for the whole property. So we're taking out the assessed value and maximum assessed value pieces because the limit calculation is for the whole property, not for just the parts. Section 5 implements that. Section 6 was, it has to do with farm use and the home site value, how you calculate that. There on page 4 of the bill, line 42, it's an erroneous reference. It was meant to be the subsection 3 rather than subsection 2. We've talked to the Farm Bureau about this, and they're okay on it, in terms of how the calculation should be made. Section 7 provides for the implementation of that. Section 8, we're asking that it be deleted, and that's in the Dash 15 amendments, because another bill that's come through, House Bill 2044, has already passed both houses and been signed by the governor, and it corrects this. So that's been taken care of. Section 9 implements that, so we want 8 and 9 out. Section 10 has to do with the Board of Tax Appeals at the county level.
Sections 8 and 9 are that's the Dash 13 amendments?
I think it's the 15. And Section 10, it has to do with appeals to the Board of Tax Appeals at the county level, first step for property tax appeals. What it does there is clarify. There's some question of when you go take that first step of what you can appeal, and we want to clarify that you can, a taxpayer can appeal either the market value that the assessor came up with on the property or the calculation of the limit. And the current law is a little fuzzy on what it is they can appeal. We want a taxpayer to be able to challenge anything in terms of the calculation of their tax when you get to the assessed value. So this is trying to clarify that you can challenge any piece of that. Section 11 also has to do with the Board of Tax Appeals, and that is has to do with last session. You changed the law in terms of appeals to the tax court on who could appeal. And what you added in was to owners, you added someone that had a lease that was required to pay the tax because they had an economic interest in the tax. But we didn't do it to the county board level. So we want to put that in so it's the same group of taxpayers that can appeal to the board as the ones that go to the tax court. So it's consistent. Section 12, then, also has to do with the Board of Appeals. And this has to do with, it's more of a procedural one, and that is when the boards have finished their work, they sometimes discover clerical errors. Now, clerical errors like they transposed account numbers or something in an order, and they want to go back and amend the order. So it's correct. It doesn't affect the decision in the order. It's just something that's wrong in it that they overlooked or transposed. Rather than reconvene the board to do that, which technically you have to do under current law, this section allows the board to authorize either one of its members or the clerk to go back through and correct these clerical errors only and reissue the orders. And 13 implements that. Sections 18 and 19 basically is just correcting a reference on the kind of tax year. Before, when we were under Measure 5, we changed the year so that the assessment year started July 1. It was the same as the regular tax year was July 1 to June 30th. With Measure 50, you move the assessment year back to January 1 again. These provisions deal with exemptions which trigger off of the tax year, the July 1 year, not the assessment year anymore. We're changing the reference back to the year beginning July 1, which is what exemptions relate to. And that's what we have in 18 and 19. Section 20 is just an erroneous reference that we caught. If you look at on page 10 on line 39, this subsection is dealing with average real market value. But when you get over to page 11, line 5, the reference is to maximum assessed value, which is actually the one in section 3 dealing with. So we're trying to just make that consistent. It's really the average real market value that part of this law is dealing with. Section 21 has to do with a provision that was put in last session for implementation that deals with property that's been rezoned. And the discussion was, under Measure 50, when there's rezoning, you can go back and recalculate the limit. But the decision was made last session that if you have, say, a residence and you rezone it to commercial, if the person stays in the house and lives there, then you ought to leave the Measure 50 limit for residential until they change it. So you put in a not only rezoning but a change of use. But the way it's worded under current law, it would be required all in the same year. And oftentimes, obviously, you can get rezoning in 1 year and then change the use in the next. So this basically says when it's rezoned, it's whenever you change the use, even if it's 5 years later, is when you actually go in and recalculate the limit and leave it at the old use until you change it. Section 22 implements that. Section 24 gets into urban renewal, and all it does is basically is clarifying the for both 1997 in lines on page 12, lines 17 and 18, for the 97 year, which was the first year for obviously establishing permanent rates in the Measure 50, it's putting in the correct reference on the calculation for 97, and then down in lines 37 and 38, it puts in the references to the 98 year and the years since then. Sections 25 and 26 have to do with, again, our urban renewal. And they have to do with which rate you use for the urban renewal taxes, and the distinction that we're trying to make here or clarify is that in some cases, you have offsets on rates. So if a district has its permanent rate and it gets timber money, you actually will reduce the permanent rate because of the timber money coming in. So you have a lower one. This is clarifying that for urban renewal, you use the lower rate, the one that's reduced by the offsets, not the higher rate. And that's the consolidated billing tax rate reference, both in 25 and in section 26. 27 instruments. Section 28 was added over in the House, and that has to do with under Measure 50 when we implemented. There's the old law on the property tax system that property should be physically reappraised every 6 years, called a 6 year cycle. That was eliminated because not only of changes of what the counties are doing, but obviously for a lot of homes, you don't need to go out there every 6 years because they don't change anything. You just got the 3% limit on value increase. So that was eliminated. What wasn't picked up is there's another part of the law that ties into that cycle, and that's part of the law that we call adjudicated value. And that's if you have an appeal on your house or any other property, and you get it lowered by the final decision in the appeal process, the court or whoever, then it basically gives you a 5-year period in which the assessor cannot go back out and redo the whole thing. There was a case long ago where in one county where the assessor was sort of in a fight with a taxpayer, and the taxpayer going on appeal and gets the value lowered, and the assessor says, well, it's too bad, and next year just put it back up again. And so this is trying to basically give you a time period as if you get it lowered in the appeal process, and the only thing the assessor is going to do is be making the normal adjustments made to all property, like trending. So it's not going to go in and specifically redo it. Now, there's an exception to that in the statute that says, but if it's the normal reappraisal, so if in the middle of this 5-year period, it's the normal time to come in on the 6-year cycle and reappraise, now that will start it over again. And now we've got rid of the 6-year cycle, so we're trying to redo this adjudicated statute to basically say it's still 5 years. We took out the reappraisal piece as a trigger to redo it. And then we've added some things that are consistent then with Measure 50 calculations. So it fits the Measure 50 and it fits the getting rid of the old 6-year cycle. And then Section 29 implements that.
All right, thank you. Are there questions? Appreciate your analysis. I summary, you always do. It always strikes me that what a good job, I think, the Revenue Committee of the last session did. Senator Fire.
All the errors we have to correct.
Senator Hartung participated in those. It also strikes me that neither chairman of those committees returned to the legislature. So we have some additional public hearing, I think principally involving some amendments. Mr. Rogers is here, Mr. Johansson. Mr. Corey is also coming.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Marge Gafori, representing the City of Portland. We have asked, with the Chair's indulgence, for the Dash 13 Amendment. With me is Harvey Rogers, who is with the firm of Preston Gates downtown Portland. He serves as the City of Portland's Bond Council. And also Eric Johansson, who is the GET manager for the City of Portland. Mr. Rogers will start, and Mr. Johansson will follow him.
All right. Good afternoon, Eric, members of the committee. The urban renewal statutes that were adopted to implement Measure 50 were complex. They created three options for urban renewal districts to choose among. They made an irrevocable choice at the end of fiscal year 1997-1998. Each choice allows the Urban Renewal Agency to impose a tax. Tax is the same kind of tax for all choices. But the way the statute got drafted, the language describing the tax in each choice was slightly different. One of the options, which is the option that the City of Portland picked for several urban renewal areas, has a mistake in it. And it appears to be clearly simply a mistaken cross-reference. It refers to a notice that was given in fiscal year 1998 about some indebtedness. The statute for the notice doesn't require any mention of indebtedness, and it's just simply a mistake. So the amendment that is before you, the Dash 13 amendment, is intended to correct that mistake. Mr. Johansson will say a couple of words about what correcting the mistake means to the city.
Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, Eric Johansson, debt manager in the City of Portland. Cash equity bonds have historically been some of the most complex financings that we work on for a couple of reasons. Number one, they're security structures relatively complex, and they are also susceptible to changes in the property tax system. We call them story bonds because investors need to be explained to, educated, and re-educated about what tax increment bonds mean under the current tax system. With the passage of Measure 50, the system became simpler and in some ways more stabilized. As a result, after Measure 50, we have the ability, I think, to market tax increment bonds at more favorable, meaning lower interest rates than we could prior to Measure 50 because of the increased simplicity and stabilized funding system. As Mr. Rogers mentioned, the city has a number of different districts. Four of our districts are option three districts are affected by this particular problem in the statutes. We are about to go out, or we hope soon, to issue our first series of bonds for an option three district. First passage of Measure 50. And we believe that as the first issuer of tax increment bonds for an option three district, that it's vitally important to establish the credit quality of these bonds from the get-go by bringing an issue with as few disclosure issues as possible. This amendment, we believe, will allow us to bring these bonds to market without having sort of the cloud over them that we hope to avoid. If we're successful in establishing a successful financing, and I think we will with the amendment, the interest rates that the city will bear and all other tax increment districts in the city will be improved because of the market's perception of the strength of the tax increment system in the state of Oregon. So we think it's an important amendment to include in this particular bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions? Mr. Rogers?
If Mr. Chairman, if you're satisfied with the testimony, we're happy to stop now.
You all have examined the balance of the bill, or have you, or are you just slightly interested in the one amendment you've proposed?
Mr. Chairman and members, we were part of the, certainly we followed the progress of the bill in the House Revenue Committee, so we're pretty familiar with the content, we hope.
It would just be even better with the dash.
It would be ever so much better with the dash.
Thank you for that, Senator Beyer.
To be clear, the language changes that you're making, in your opinion, do not change the way Option 3 functions. It just makes it clearer.
Senator Beyer, members of the committee, yes, that is correct. The language change we are asking for is consistent with what we understand DOR would do as an administrative rule, even if you didn't make the change. The reason it's important to us is because the city would need to disclose it in the bond offering. The disclosure would create anxiety among investors that would raise interest rates, which directly translates into increased taxes. So this amendment will actually lower the total amount of taxes that need to be collected for urban renewal districts. Because
did you prepare this in cooperation with the Department of Revenue?
It was prepared between me and one of the city attorneys, forwarded to the Legislative Council's office. It's my understanding secondhand that DOR has no objection to this amendment, that it's acceptable to the chair of the committee, and it's also been approved by the Association of Oregon Renewal Agencies, which is the group of statewide urban renewal agencies that follow this.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Barr?
Might just to get it on the record, if we could ask Mr. Menarius.
I would be happy to do that.
Agree with that?
Thinking as we proceed with these amendments, just seeing if there is anyone else who wishes to comment on that testimony and specifically request the Department of Revenue for comments on the Dash 13.
Jim Maneri for the record with the Department of Revenue. We just saw them, so I'm not sure we have any objection to them.
Well, I'll let you return to the back of the room, and if you want to take a look at them, and if you develop some concerns, we'd be happy to hear about them. Yes, Senator Barr?
Jim, as you look at it, my real question is just, you know, whether you agree with the proposed position that this is indeed consistent with the way the department would administer under current law, that it's just a clarification.
We're happy to do that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you. We also have Annette Newingham. Did I do that right? Newingham. All right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Annette Newingham for the record, and I'm here representing the Association of County Clerks, Oregon. And this is pertaining to the A-12 amendment. I'm here to urge your support of the proposed amendments that would enable the Board of Property Tax Appeals to convene on or after the first Monday in February. Current law currently requires that they convene on the first Monday in February. I gave an example in the testimony I presented that, like Lane County, we have about 570 appeals this last session, and we certainly want to convene at the very beginning because we need to be sure that we can meet the April 15th deadline. Another example is like Union County. They had 24 appeals, and what they're having to do is to convene, then they reschedule, and then later they come back together because they're not ready to hear the appeals, a few that they happen to have. This will give better flexibility for all the counties, regardless of their size. And that's pretty much it. I have contacted the Department of Revenue, and they are aware of them, of these amendments, and have not indicated any concerns for them.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions?
Thank you.
Thank you again. Is there anyone who wished to comment on the Dash 12 amendment? All right. We have Mr. Carlson.
Good Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Gary Carlson with Associated Oregon Industries, and I wanted to speak with you briefly about the A-15 amendment. This issue came forward actually during legislative session. There is life outside of the building during legislative session, and this came up in terms of appeal, litigation with regard to industrial valuation under our property tax laws. And there seemed to be a gray area with regard to 308.411, having to do with an option for a plant owner to have his property appraised for property tax purposes without regard to using the income approach. As you know, we have three approaches to value, and the income approach for many closely held small industrial owners is a very critical element to them, retaining the confidentiality and the closeness of the income data of those plants. It's not an issue with big board companies. It is an issue with many small, closely held companies. And the issue arose over over data which could be perceived to be income-type data with regard to functional obsolescence issues with regard to a mill. And we met with the Department of Revenue Management earlier this year to discuss this problem and issue, and concluded that it probably would need to be refined and clarified, and we felt that the best way to do that would be an amendment to the 308.411 statute, which you see before you. So Mr. Maneri worked from the department's side, and we have reviewed and passed among our membership for review these proposed amendments, and find that they will address the issue that was raised in this litigation and solve the problem, I think, favorably to both sides of the equation. Mr. Maneri may want to speak to it further.
Thank you, Mr. Maneri. We'd be glad to have your comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jim Maneri. As Mr. Carlson mentioned, we did work out this solution that we think works well for the taxpayer and the department in terms of giving the taxpayer some flexibility in what information they want to protect that can't be used in the appraisal versus other that they can provide. And then it can be just an evaluation. This statute is a sort of trade-off between trying to protect the proprietary interests of especially a small company for data that normally they would need to put a market value on their plant. And this just gives them a second option in terms of providing information to it.
Question, Senator Byron.
Jim and Gary, is the concern the protection of proprietary information?
Mr. Chair and Senator Byer, yes, I think it is. It is income data in particular. That's why you see the dichotomy here in the statute in this proposed amendment between income data and expense data, which was the focus of the discussion with regard to the litigation I mentioned. Was is some of this expense data, excess operating cost indicators, are they really income type data and therefore can't be utilized in the appraisal? That was the issue. And so we've devised a division, a new option, if you will, for a plant owner to elect not to reveal any income data, but to agree to the release the utilization of operating expense data, which will help the appraisers to determine whether or not there is functional obsolescence in the plant.
So it's not an issue of disclosure of proprietary information, then. It's the more, you're saying it's a more accurate way to predict value.
I'm not sure I understand your question, Senator Byer. Jim, maybe you do, but I think that the owners of some of these facilities are willing to divulge cost data for the purposes of trying to arrive at an accurate value for the plant.
Mm-hmm.
But many of them would still be unwilling to reveal all of their plant income data.
Don't they have to do that in their income tax reports anyway?
In income tax reports, they do, which are closely guarded in the department.
Am I wrong, Jim? Isn't this just all protected from disclosure by the department staff, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, yes, that's true. Just first of all, we do not share income tax information across the property tax side. Guard that. So we don't have access to that. This is, I might say, in terms of proprietary, this is a dispute that arose back around 1980, I think. It came out of Douglas County. The department was seeking information about some of the mills to try to value them. The small owners in particular objected, saying that that information about how much money we earn off these plants is very critical to us in competing, and we don't want to release it, even though we guard it as confidential. I mean, and so the issue came to the legislature, and a compromise was made in the law saying, okay, if you want to protect it, you can. So you have an election to protect it. So this information oftentimes is used actually to put a lower value on a plant. What will happen is we'll use the traditional approach of looking at what it would cost new to build the plant and try to depreciate it down to what we think it's worth. But if there's things going on in the economy, like log supply, and other things that wouldn't be measured by the cost, oftentimes you can look at income and expense information as to whether they, for instance, have excess costs to run the plant, or their income's way down because of log supply or something else. You can use that to try to measure the lowering of value of the plant. But these owners wanted to guard that so much, the legislature made a compromise and said, okay, you can guard it, but the price you pay is that information now can't be used fundamentally to lower your value. And that was acceptable to them. What we have here is the way it was structured. It was all income and expense information. And what we've had in the discussions is that a number of companies are willing to release the expense part, the income they want to guard. And so what this amendment does is said, well, you can do one of two elections. You can do the current one and protect all of it, and it won't be used in your appraisal. Or you can release the expense and only guard the income information. In that case, we could get the expense information from them and do our appraisal with that, and it just wouldn't be income that's used. And that seemed to be something that would work for both of us.
Does it work? It seems like you only use half a balance sheet.
Senator Beyer, the expense information is most often used for functional obsolescence, which means the excess costs to run the plant. So if you have an inefficient line, so you've got to use heisters to move the product instead of a conveyor belt. You incur extra expense to try to put out the product, and therefore a buyer will probably pay you less money. They're buying into that excess expense. We can pick up that piece of it with the expense information.
I guess the bottom line is we're comfortable that with the amendment, it will allow the department to put a fair appraised value on.
Senator Beyer, we think we, at least with the expense information, certainly we can... We can measure things now that are losses of value to the plant that we can't without the information. So it moves us closer to trying to get a market value on the plant.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we have Mr. DiLorenzo.
I look at this one close.
Like you all close. That is Senator Beyer. We welcome.
Welcome, John.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo, and I'm appearing here today in my personal capacity and on behalf, and as a half owner of Commodore LLC, which is the owner of the Commodore Apartments, located at 1615 Southwest Morrison Street across from the Civic Stadium. The Commodore consists of approximately 71 apartment units, the Commodore Cafe, the Commodore Bar and Grill, the Commodore Grocery and some other retail space. The structure is one of the city's last remaining examples of Art Deco design, and for that reason is on the National Historic Registry and has participated in Oregon's Historic Property Tax Relief Program over the years. That program under ORS Chapter 358 allows qualified properties to receive a property tax freeze for 15 years if substantial sums are invested in the rehabilitation of the property. Now, the prior owner, the owner who owned the building prior to my group, in fact made such a substantial investment and enrolled the property in the program. Several sessions ago, primarily in response to the Americans with Disabilities Act, the legislature amended the statute to permit owners of historic properties who were on a 15-year schedule to sign up for an additional 15 years of an assessment freeze at the same assessed valuation if the owners, the new owners, made substantial new improvements in primarily one of three areas, either seismic retrofitting or with respect to energy conservation or with respect to accessibility issues that were now required under the Americans with Disabilities Act. My group contracted to purchase this building in reliance upon this section in early 1977, knowing that the assessed valuation could be preserved for an additional 15 years. That assumption was, in fact, factored into the price, and that is because the price of a building, a commercial building, is normally viewed merely as a flow of earnings. The less that is paid on taxes or any other item, then offsets the net operating income, and the higher the net operating income, the higher the valuation for the building. Therefore, the price is set based on those factors. Well, at the time we began our transaction, the 1997 session of the legislature also considered taking another look at the historic tax program and considered whether upon the renewal, the 15-year renewal, either the original assessed valuation should be preserved or whether that assessed valuation should be stepped up to reflect the new Measure 50 adjusted assessed valuation, which would then continue for the next 15-year period of time. So the choice before several legislative committees and several bills was, do we preserve the original assessed valuation or do we step it up and then freeze it for the next 15 years? There were two bills that addressed this last session. One was Senate Bill 1215, which you all know about, and that was the Measure 50 implementing legislation, the 200-page bill that Mr. Mineri has referred to. There were also provisions in Senate Bill 1103 last session, which pertained to historic properties. That bill, Senate Bill 1103, took the latter approach, that approach being step up the assessment freeze, the assessment valuation for the next 15 years. Don't allow an owner to be entitled to the original 15-year or the original assessed valuation. At that time, I made an appeal before the House Revenue Committee because we were literally in the midst of our transaction and had already pegged the purchase price based upon the law as it stood at the time we contracted to purchase the property. And at the time, we argued for a transition rule. Our view was that any time the legislature changes the tax code, the legislature should at least be mindful of those who have committed themselves contractually in reliance upon the law that exists at the time that they signed their contracts. And although changes should be made prospectively, under certain circumstances, folks who had transaction pending should be allowed through transition to avail themselves of the prior law. The House Revenue Committee was evidently persuaded by the fairness argument. Senator Beyer, I imagine, will remember this. He served on the House Revenue Committee at the time. The committee unanimously approved the amendment, and the House passed the bill with the other material in it overwhelmingly. However, by the time the bill got to the Senate, it was lost on the cutting room floor on the wee hours of July 4th, and the Senate never acted on the bill. Well, Senate Bill 1215 also had the language, but without the transition clause. This becomes even further complicated, though, because although Senate Bill 1215 last session attempted to require the assessed valuation to step up for the next 15-year period, the Oregon Tax Court this January ruled that the language in Senate Bill 1215 was ambiguous, and it did not have that effect. That case was Multnomah County versus Elorriaga and the Department of Revenue. Interestingly, Multnomah County has elected not to appeal that tax court decision, and so for the time being, the tax court decision stands. However, I believe that it is likely that at some point in time, this issue will reach the Oregon Supreme Court. And so what we are asking you for is for, in essence, insurance for those people, and there are probably 8 or 9 transactions involving other parties at the time, which were involved, that clearly relied upon the law as it existed in 1997 in structuring their transactions. This amendment would allow any such party to who purchased within 5 years of the effective date of this act. The clause 2 years ago talked about 3 years back, so we've just added 2 years to that to cover the same group. Any party who purchased within 5 years of this act to within 1 year after the effective date of this act make an application for an additional 15-year period and to basically be able to avail themselves under the law which existed at the time that they signed contracts in reliance upon that law. So that is the purpose of the amendment, and we would ask that much in the same way as the House Revenue Committee and the House felt that the arguments were compelling, that you would view them the same way.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, does this, at the end of the second period, the permanent rate, is it adjusted up to market value?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, no. The purpose of the transition rule is to allow those people who found themselves in that situation to be able to avail themselves of the prior law, which allows the second time for the original assessed valuation to carry over to that second 15-year period. Interestingly, though, that seems to be the way it's going to be for everyone for the time being, because the county hasn't appealed this particular tax court ruling anyway. However, I believe that it is likely that this issue will, through another case, probably find its way to the Supreme Court. And without a transition rule, there's really nothing to protect those parties who, again, found themselves in that very interesting situation that had transactions in process as the law changed, from being able to avail themselves under the old law.
I can put it back in my mind. The property was frozen, could have been frozen 15 years before 1997, the law took effect.
Right.
So 50, in the absence of that, 50 would have adjusted it to the 1995 level, less 10%.
Correct. And then that could have been frozen for another 15 years. But you know what's really interesting about all
I'm getting back and through this, do we have 30 years? Do we go back 30 years to that value, to this permanent value?
No. Well, it would be the valuation at the time the reapplication is made. But the valuation at the time the reapplication is made is the valuation that was frozen for potentially up to 15 years ago. The way this amendment is written is, you know, you may be 10 years into your tax freeze. You can make the application for another 15-year extension now, and you would have a total of 25 as opposed to 30, because
that's your permanent value.
That
value frozen 20 years ago or whatever would be the permanent value when the freeze is over with.
The permanent value when the freeze is over with would be whatever the Measure 50 would provide if Measure 50 is still around in 10 to 15 years. But this really raises another issue which we need not really mention too much here, but it's the value of these exemptions at all. Because in light of Measure 50, many of the exemption programs which prevent assessed valuations from rising are really of limited value, since assessed valuations cannot rise by more than 3% anyway, that raises an interesting question as to what incentives they provide anyone to do anything. And there's 20 exemption programs, and most people in the business community are not really willing to go under most of them because there's no reason. There's no incentive that's any longer provided. There would be incentive here with these amendments, at least for that group of people who, again, had transactions pending at the time the law changed. So all we're arguing for here is a transition rule, and if people made contracts in reliance upon the law as it existed on the books, it's our view that they should be able to avail themselves of the law that existed at the time as long as they do it within a reasonable period of time.
Senator Beyer.
One thing I might ask Mr. Mineri a question.
Sure. Mr. Mineri, you've been summoned.
Jim, how does this parallel the enterprise zones or the multifamily tax exemptions where they're out on the tax rolls for a while until the exemption is over with and they make more? How are they adjusted under 50?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, any properties coming off a specially assessed program like this, basically what you do is you determine the market value and then you use a ratio on it so that it gets the same level of tax break as other similar properties are enjoying under Measure 50.
Well, that would be different than this situation in that this was already on the roll, so you'd be treating that whatever that value would have been in 1995 for fixing the permanent assessed value of it.
Senator Bart, are you talking about what comes off the program, say at the end of the 30 years or whenever it's run? I believe it comes back on regular market value.
It comes back to full market. Or maximum assessed value purposes.
Yeah.
Adjusted up.
This protects it for that time period. Right. For either the 15 or the 30 or whatever it's run, it protects it from the normal market value assessment with the Measure 50 limits in place.
Right. So it's not locked in at whatever it was on in 1995?
No.
Other questions? Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, while I'm here, could I just, again, you asked me about the 813 amendment for urban renewal.
Yes.
In answer to the questions, first of all, we've looked at the language, and we believe it's consistent with current practice. It doesn't change urban renewal calculations as it's done now. And I would like, for the record, to say that Ms. Gafori did call me and inform me that there would be amendments. I just hadn't seen the actual wording that we can look at, so we're okay with it.
Thank you very much. Appreciate those comments. Or anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2129?
Yeah.
Come on up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lynn McNamara from the League of Oregon City. Just very briefly on the A14, we would be interested in the revenue impact from this, the situation that Mr. DiLorenzo described and the wording of the amendment, I'm not sure actually jive with 8 or 9 people. It may not, and we would be interested in knowing how this will affect properties statewide and what the revenue impact on cities would be as a result.
You have no position at this time, and
we would prefer not to see a greater revenue loss to cities.
I understand. Okay. Mr.
Beyer. I can't recall if the League opposed this on the House side in 97.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I honestly don't know. I wasn't here.
Remember much?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else wishing to testify House Bill 2129? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2129. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2129. We have before us a series of amendments to House Bill 2129.
Sure.
I'm ready. Yes, Senator Beyer.
-12 amendments.
Senator Beyer moves the -12 amendments to House Bill 2129. Is there a discussion? Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, amendment is agreed to.
So I would move the dash A13 amendment.
The dash A13 amendments have been moved to House Bill 2129. Is there a discussion? Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the amendment is agreed to.
Chair moved the dash A14 amendments.
Senator Byer moves the dash A14 amendments to House Bill 2129. It has been called to my attention that a slight change is needed in the dash 14s on line 14. After the reference to ORS 358.545, should appear in place of, which, let me just restate that, strike as amended and in effect on the date of purchase, insert in parenthesis 1995
edition. 1995
edition.
Edition or edition?
Edition. As in the book. All right.
And a period after the
word edition. So with that change, it has been moved and it's in this friendly amendment to the dash 14. Is there discussion? Is there objection? And we'll get an impact statement. So
just for the record, Mr. Chair, I do remember that about dealing with it in the House. We did spend a lot of time, and I don't recall any objections to it. That's why I was asking. There might have been, but I don't recall them. I remember supporting it last time.
Well, as you recall, also the closing ceremonies were not as orderly as we would expect them to be this year. So if there's no objection on the dash 14, they are agreed to.
Mr. Chair, I would move the dash A15 amendment.
Senator Byer moves the dash 15 amendment, A15 to House Bill 2129. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the amendment is agreed to.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2129A as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Thank you. Senator Byer moves House Bill 2129 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Byer.
Aye.
Senator
Byer. Aye.
Senator
Byer. Aye. Aye. House Bill 2129 is passed to the floor. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2129, and we will thank Senator Byer for continuing his interest in Measure 50 and and is agreeing to carry that on the floor. Is there anything further to come before the committee? I look forward to seeing you all at 6 p.m. It's a big show tonight.
It's a big show.
We are adjourned.